Welcome everyone to the Arthroscopy Association's Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Andrea Spiker from the University of Wisconsin. Today, I am joined by Dr. Vikas Kanduja, who is a consultant orthopedic surgeon and associate professor at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. He is also the Hunterian Professor at the Royal College of Surgeons. Dr. Kanduja has expertise in both arthroplasty and sports medicine surgeries of the hip and knee. Dr. Kanduja was a senior author of two systematic reviews that we are going to discuss today. The first, Viscosupplementation is Effective for the Treatment of Osteoarthritis in the Hip, a systematic review. And the second, titled Hip Arthroscopy in Patients with Generalized Joint Hypermobility Yields Successful Outcomes, a systematic review, both of which are in press in the Arthroscopy Journal. Welcome, Dr. Kanduja, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrea. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Vic, it's great to have you joining us from the United Kingdom. Can you please start by telling us about yourself and your practice?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm a consultant orthopedic surgeon in Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge. This is essentially a teaching tertiary university hospital. And I run the hip preservation or the young adult hip service in Cambridge for the whole of East of England. So we do serve a population of over about 6 million, and we do both hip preservation and arthroplasty procedures as well. And I've been doing that for about 15 years now. So in a nutshell, that's what the practice is. We also have a fairly well-developed research group with 6 PhD students. And the main focus of the research group is twofold, looking at outcomes following hip preservation, and also looking at ways and means of actually improving our surgery through technology. So robotics, discrete element analysis form a part of that. A fairly busy clinical academic practice in Cambridge. So that's it in a nutshell, Andrea.
Excellent. So today we'll be discussing two systematic reviews that you've recently published in the Arthroscopy Journal. The first is on viscosupplementation as a treatment for hip osteoarthritis, and then the second is related to the outcomes after hip arthroscopy in patients with generalized joint hypermobility. So can you tell the listeners why you decided to investigate these topics in particular?
Yeah, sure. So we'll start off with the first one, and that's the viscosupplementation one. Now, if you're offering both, i.e. arthroplasty and hip preservation procedures in your practice, then there is a large number of patients who actually fall with what I call within the treatment gap. So if you've got FAI and grade 0 tonus or grade 1 tonus, you can still get away with the hip preservation procedure. But as soon as it starts getting to tonus 2, tonus 3, then those patients are struggling and they're obviously fairly young. They may not benefit as much with arthroscopic intervention for over a long period of time. And they may not be ready in terms of their age and also in terms of the disease process for an arthroplasty. So for these individuals, what we have in the UK is an organization called NICE, which is the National Institute of Health Clinical Excellence. And they recommend that we give these patients steroid injections. But again, we've seen in our practice that the steroid injections may not last longer than 6 months or maximum for a year. So the thought process was, what else could we be giving these patients? And the two other agents basically which have been used have been viscosupplementation with hyaluronic acid. And the second one is PRP. So prior to designing any sort of randomized controlled trial on which is the best agent amongst steroids or viscosupplementation or PRP, the first thing was to look at what the literature says on these. And therefore, we've done actually two, both systematic reviews on the PRP and also on viscosupplementation. So that was the thought process behind this study.
Excellent. So actually, let's continue to talk about that first study. We've heard a lot about hyaluronic acid in the knee, for example. What do you think the literature is showing us in as far as the difference between what we know with hyaluronic acid in the knee versus in the hip? For example, do you think it's lagging as far as our knowledge on its use in the hip? And perhaps does this have something to do with the fact that people have a lower threshold to pull the trigger on a hip replacement when compared to a knee replacement?
I think it's definitely one of the reasons is that, but also it's about license for use. So hyaluronic acid has generally been licensed for use in the knee, but not so much in the hip. So in the UK, definitely there are significant restrictions for the use of HA in the hip. And that's why we're not seeing that much of it in the literature. In fact, all our studies just amounted to just over 3,300 patients in this study. So as you correctly mentioned, not a lot out there in the literature if we compare it to the knee. And predominantly, I think that's because of the labeling that HA goes with for the knee rather than for the hip.
And can you tell us a little bit about your own experience with HA in the hip? I'm curious to know if this would differ than what we experience here in the U.S. Similar, you know, we have the problem where it's off-label and often out of pocket to get the hyaluronic acid injected into the hip. But what is your experience in the UK?
That's exactly the same, Andrea. So it's actually patients who will come wanting that because they've read about it or they've had anecdotal reports from their friends that it's worked for them in the knee or in the hip, and then they'll come specifically asking for it. So essentially out of pocket rather than general use, and very infrequent as well.
Is that your experience with PRP? You mentioned that earlier as well as one of the viscose supplementation alternatives.
So personally, I haven't used PRP for the hip at all. And I'm very keen to start a randomized controlled trial here in Cambridge on all these agents. And therefore, we did the systematic review on PRPs as well. So we don't routinely use PRPs at all, actually, for OA in the hip at all in Cambridge.
Yeah, and it's very differing across the different regions of the United States as well, Vic, but I have the same experience here in Wisconsin where it's a very big challenge for me to get PRP in the hip or even hyaluronic acid in the hip for our patients here, you know, with basically patients having to pay out of pocket and not a lot of places offering that to patients if they are willing to pay out of pocket. So it seems like a very similar experience we have.
And I would say it's rightly so as well, because if you look at all the studies out there and the literature out there, it's the efficacy is definitely not proven over a longer period of time. Definitely if you compare it to the knee data. So until and unless we've got good evidence to support its regular use, I think it should only be used in trial conditions.
And I do wonder, again, mentioning, you know, that lower threshold to put a hip replacement in a patient compared to a knee replacement, if that might be going hand in hand with our lack of investigations into this area. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think the difference, we work predominantly in the NHS, and each intervention that you offer the patient has to, you've got to ensure that it is economically the best option for that patient, and it's the last resort. So I don't think our threshold for hip replacement is low. I think that will definitely be considered as the last resort, and we'll keep trying injections till the joint is really diseased and the patient cannot function. So I think the thresholds may be different in the two places just because of the way our systems are.
That's an excellent point, and I agree with you. It's not something I thought about before, but you know, definitely I see that in my arthroplasty partners here in the U.S. I think they're much more willing to put in a hip replacement earlier in the arthritic process than a knee replacement, just because of how well our hip replacements do.
Sure.
Now, let's talk specifically about the findings in your systematic review. So you found that there was, as you mentioned, over 3,000 participants in the systematic review. You found there was weak evidence to support that viscose supplementation improved patient-reported pain and function compared to baseline, and that was regardless of the dose, volume, composition, or number of injections. And can you, you know, based on these results, just tell us a little bit about how you interpret these and whether this will change how you use viscose supplementation in your practice in the future?
Okay, so that's a very good question, Andrea. And when we set out the study, we really wanted to see what's the total duration that the HA would act on, what's the ideal dose, what would be the ideal composition, because there are different compositions of HA available. how many number of injections do we need to give to get the ideal outcomes, and are there any adverse effects? So these were the four or five things that we were actually looking at in terms of our outcome measures. But the truth of the matter is that there is so much of high heterogeneity in the data out there and very low sort of evidence data that you cannot make any conclusive judgments from the data that is out there. So that's why I would definitely interpret the results with caution. I would say that it's probably safe to say that HA does not cause any major adverse effects. And irrespective of the dose, duration, composition, you do get to see a beneficial effect at 1, 3, and 6 months in pain, and also in some PROMs. But because of the heterogeneity of the data and there's no standardization, I think you've got to be very cautious in interpreting that data. So what I'm taking away from here is that it's a safe thing to use, and it's improving to some extent, but obviously there is reporting bias because you're only reporting positive studies out here. And it really needs a good randomized controlled trial to figure out what exactly is going on. But in that randomized controlled trial, we have to be very careful about what dose we're going to put in, what kind of molecular weight HA we are going to put in, how many number of injections, and what's the duration. So all these factors have to be actually carefully put in before we start that randomized controlled trial. And that's what we're getting out of this paper.
Very thoughtful interpretation and excellent conclusions drawn there. Next, let's discuss the other article we wanted to talk about today on patients with generalized joint hypermobility. So maybe first, can you begin by telling us why you wanted to do a systematic review on this topic?
Yeah, again, so I think all the studies that we do, Andrea, are actually coming or are done because there are genuine questions in the clinic. And this started off with one of my fellows asking me, there was a patient with generalized hypermobility in clinic, so, and they asked me, are their outcomes any different to the standard patients who come in without any generalized hypermobility? And I did not have an answer to that question at that particular point in time. I said, fine, let's do a systematic review and let's see what the outcomes are and are they any different or not. So that's how it started off, because we genuinely didn't know what the outcomes are of patients with generalized hypermobility who are actually having a hip arthroscopy. So that was the impetus for the study. And the other important thing was that almost about 20 to 40% of the patients who are having hip arthroscopy will have generalized joint hypermobility. So a large volume of our patients do land up having generalized hypermobility, and we do not know what their outcomes are or whether they're different to patients without generalized hypermobility. So that was the rationale for actually doing this study.
Now, how do you define generalized joint hypermobility in your clinical practice?
So again, extremely good question. And I always had a Batten score of over 5 as the definition. But when we did this study, there were papers which reported hypermobility as more than 4 on Batten's, more than 5, and more than 6. So technically, for the purpose of this study, we've taken Batten score as over 4 as a definition of generalized hypermobility.
Wonderful. And now when a patient who has a Batten score over 4 presents to your clinic, and you've diagnosed them with generalized joint hypermobility, how do you counsel them on how hip arthroscopy and their outcomes might differ due to their connective tissue status?
Yeah, so prior to the study, I would definitely be telling them that the results may not be as good as patients who do not have this. But certainly after the study, I'm a bit more confident in telling them that 65% of the patients who actually underwent hip arthroscopy and had generalized hypermobility actually ended up having good outcomes in terms of achieving the MCID or the PASS. So you definitely have some good data from this paper, which you can actually counsel the patient with now.
Agreed. And that leads me into my next point. I'd like to highlight the conclusion from your paper, which you stated that with effective labral repair and capsule closure, outcomes achieved in patients with generalized joint hypermobility are comparable to those reported in patients without hypermobility. So I absolutely completely agree with this statement. And can you tell us why, in your mind, especially in patients with generalized joint hypermobility, the labral repair and capsule closure, as opposed to labral debridement or leaving the capsule open after hip arthroscopy, is so important?
Yeah, sure. So I think for starters, the capsule is fairly thin in patients who've got generalized hypermobility, and that's sort of well evidenced. And once the capsule is thin, if you don't land up repairing it, especially if you're making a large capsulotomy, like a T-shaped capsulotomy, then there is enough evidence out there that there are more complications in these patients. Secondly, within this study, if you look at majority of the patients actually had capsular closure, and that's why these outcomes were reasonably good. What we do not know is, and therefore that last statement, again, to be interpreted with caution, what we do not know is that if these patients were left alone, all these patients, and without capsular closure, would their outcomes have been different? Because, again, we do not have the luxury of a randomized controlled trial here. This is the data that is available out there. But having said that, again, all these patients who had capsular closure had achieved their MCID, and a lot of them achieved patient acceptable state as well. So based on that, that's why we've made, and obviously the biomechanical studies with thinner capsule being closed, we've made that statement towards the end that it's probably ideal to have capsular closure in these patients with generalized hypermobility to get optimal outcomes.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, I completely agree with you. And one thing that I found actually challenging in this group of patients with hypermobility is, especially in those with a diagnosis of connective tissue disorders such as Ehlers-Danlos, sometimes you can do the perfect capsular closure and their healing of that closure may not be very predictable. And so that introduces yet another challenge in this cohort of patients. Have you experienced that as well?
Absolutely correct. Completely concur with you on that. And that's why the mantra is generally in Europe, we have anyway gone down the route of going through three or four portals and doing small periportal capsulotomies rather than sort of T or L-shaped capsulotomies, and much more so in these patients. So small capsulotomies, multiple portals, and do as minimal as possible in terms of what's required. And if required, obviously, if you're doing large capsulotomies, then capsular closures for them as well.
Yeah, we've heard more and more about the periportal entry into the hip capsule. So I think there's more to be learned about that, especially in this cohort of patients.
Yeah, and we've sort of been influenced by the Dean's peripheral compartment approach and the Dean's portal. So most of us will do our sort of peripheral compartment work through the Dean's portal. So you land up making an additional portal anyway, and therefore your capsulotomies are generally smaller.
And for those who aren't familiar with the Dean's portal, can you describe what that is?
Yeah, so the Dean's portal is essentially to access the peripheral compartment described by Michael Dean's from Germany. And between the anterior superior iliac spine and the greater trochanter, two-thirds, one-third, you get your a needle pointing towards the head-neck junction. And then you go underneath the capsule to access the peripheral compartment from there. So that's the Dean's portal.
Well, thank you, Vic. This was such an enlightening discussion on two excellent systematic reviews that are in the Arthroscopy Journal. Before we finish, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with the listeners?
Take the results from both these systematic reviews with caution because of the high heterogeneity of the data that's out there. But certainly, both of them allow us to standardize future studies so that randomized controlled trials can be done appropriately, both on the viscous supplementation side and also on the capsular closure versus leaving it open for these particular patients with generalized hypermobility.
Excellent advice. Thank you very much.
Andrea, absolute pleasure being with you on this podcast.
Thank you again. Dr. Kanduja's articles titled Visco Supplementation is Effective for the Treatment of Osteoarthritis in the Hip, a Systematic Review, as well as Hip Arthroscopy in Patients with Generalized Joint Hypermobility Yields Successful Outcomes, a Systematic Review, can be found online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes our episode of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. Thank you for joining us. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal.